Images from Marriage, Commentary for the April 19, 2025 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Galatians 3, verse 28. Our Seventh-day Adventist denomination is guilty of adultery. Instead of marriage to the bridegroom, they have fallen in love with male headship, a patriarchal view of the Bible that insists that one gender dominates another, derived from the culture popular during biblical times. This is why we end up with statements like the following in our Sabbath School Quarterly. Here are three principles for marriage. First, forgive your spouse, however undeserving, just as Christ forgives us, however undeserving. Second, accept your spouse, faults and all, just as Christ accepts us, faults and all. Third, just as Christ put us before himself, put your spouse before yourself. While the author carefully avoided the use of the pronouns he and she, no abused woman reading this would ever feel that the church had any love for her, only for her abusive spouse. Such statements only load the victim with guilt and acquit the abuser. This itself constitutes pastoral abuse of the gravest sort. It causes me to wonder how many pastoral spouses suffer under such patriarchal domination, including mental and physical abuse. Such an attitude as this quote portrays a kind of spiritual narcissism that develops when a spouse feels that since they are God's representative, they are above question, even in the relative seclusion of their own home. It allows pastors or anyone claiming patriarchal headship to escape responsibility for the hell they turn their relationships into because their victim was not being submissive. The idea of headship comes from proof texts in both the Old and New Testaments. In Genesis, it originates from the fall into sin in chapter 3, where we read, "I will make your pains in childbearing very severe. With painful labor you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." Genesis 3, verse 16. There are three things patriarchal dominators read into this text. One, the male rule is a woman's penalty for her sin. Two, it is okay to ameliorate the pain of childbirth, but not the effects of male domination. And three, they overlook that the male ruling over her may be the result of his sin and its curse, and not hers. I know from personal experience, whenever I am even tempted to be harsh to my spouse, it is a result of my sinful nature, not hers. These three assumptions have led us down a very dark path in human relationships. Not only has disrespect for women led to mental and physical abuse, it has allowed the proliferation of polygamy in the Old Testament and adultery throughout history by men who convinced themselves it was a sinful woman who enticed them to betray their spouses instead of owning up to their own sinful natures. In the New Testament, we have Ephesians 5:22, Colossians 3:18, and 1 Peter 3, verse 1, all telling wives to submit to their husbands. The Apostle Paul, as an incel, according to 1 Corinthians 7, verse 8, tended toward misogyny in some of his epistles. He reacted negatively toward women who might be tempted to question his authority as an itinerant evangelist, as exemplified in 1 Corinthians 14, verses 34 and 35. The Apostle Peter, who was drawn to Paul's leadership, though he himself was married, may have been simply parroting Paul's position toward women, although Peter's statement in his first epistle reveals this is a legalistic position and not one of grace and faith. That Paul tended to dominate those around him can be seen in his rebuke to Peter, mentioned in Galatians chapter 2, verses 11 through 13, and his falling out with Barnabas over John Mark in Acts 15, verses 14 through 40. It brings into question whether Paul could ever see himself as mutually submissive to any man, let alone a woman. It is a strange irony, however, that women tended to be the gateways for evangelism as he traveled. Lydia from Thyatira in Acts 16, verses 13 through 15, Priscilla in Corinth in Acts 18, verses 1 through 3, and Phoebe from Cenchreae in Romans 16, verses 1 and 2, all played major roles in the early church and were lauded by Paul. Priscilla even instructed Apollos, another traveling evangelist from Alexandria, to a better understanding of the faith, according to Acts 18, verses 24 through 26. This makes it even more strange that Paul would tell those in Corinth, the place he met Aquila and Priscilla, that women needed to keep silent in church. In Acts and Epistles, it is Aquila and Priscilla only twice, once in Acts and once in a Corinthian epistle. All the remaining mentions are Priscilla and Aquila, giving her preeminence in addressing their work in the early church. These relationships call into question Paul's statement about keeping silent in church as any kind of a universal requirement. That most churches do not follow this practice today argues that this is commonly understood in modern congregations. Headship theology tends to be in bed with perfectionism. So Peter's reference to women submitting, being according to the law, would appeal to that mindset. Tying the two into a common package. However, the idea that making women remain silent in church and denying them pastoral opportunities as a way for the church to be saved is heretical. For we are not saved by the law. It only condemns us and reveals our hypocrisy when we claim to submit to God and then demand that others based on their gender submit to us as entitled males. We acknowledge that the church is married to Christ as the bridegroom, and although we would never urge the church to be married to Satan instead, we effectually do the same when we encourage wives to submit to devilishly abusive husbands, even to their own destruction, mentally and physically. We have no right to even suggest such a horror to others. As Christians, we are called to relieve suffering where we can, not perpetuate it through evil counsel. The cursed marriage model in Genesis 3:16 is not salvific. We should seek to ameliorate the pain of that curse, just as we do for childbirth. It seems strange that we can ease that pain, and we can lessen the influence of the curse of the thorns and thistles in Genesis 3:18 with herbicides and weeding implements, but our male patriarchy must leave hands off for lessening the curse in any way of male dominance. It is as though we are saying, we were both cursed, but at least I get to boss her around, even physically abuse her if I want to, because God said I get to. The Apostle John said that those who claim to have a relationship with God but are unloving are liars, in 1 John 4, verse 20. Lies do not originate with God. They come from the enemy, according to John 8, 44, and pave the path to perdition. Those lies by both clergy and laity are well known by the spouses they abuse and will rise to condemn those unloving souls who live out the lies by victimizing others. As a church, we should not be enablers of such abuse. Despite the parable of the Good Samaritan who bound up the wounds of a fellow traveler when the good religious people failed to lift a finger to help, we still pass by on the other side, clicking our tongues at the poor victim who failed to be submissive and forgiving. Those victims will testify against us as well on that day for our stone-cold hearts when the judgment is set. We do not need to be such heartless people. We can change our direction, and instead of walking deeper into darkness, we can start walking toward the light of God's love. He has wanted to walk with us ever since humanity walked away from him in Eden. And with tears in his voice, he cried out to Adam and Eve, Where are you? He does the same for us today, asking continually, Where are you? If we turn to him and begin walking together with him, he will cure our hard hearts, according to Ezekiel 36, verse 26. Then we can love as we were meant to from the beginning. Empathy and compassion will nest in our hearts like doves. Our great desire will be to alleviate suffering, not perpetuating those distorted theologies that increase it. It was good religious people that put Jesus on the cross. Good religious people stoned the martyr Stephen to death, according to Acts chapter 6 and 7. So-called good religious people perpetuated slavery for centuries and continue to denigrate others over not only their gender, but their ethnicity, their culture, even their speech accents. They even persecute foreigners who live among us legally when they attempt to enjoy the same rights we have, as it mentions in Leviticus 19, verse 34. Let us not become so fixated on being such good religious people that we end up condemning the innocent. There has been entirely too much of that. When we begin walking toward God, we also begin walking toward one another, but with love and humility. Empathy and compassion are hallmarks of a Christ-like heart. Let us be known for that, and not for being a means of turning the lives of others into a curse upon their heads. Jesus did not do that to us, neither should we do that to others, according to John 3, verses 16 and 17, and Matthew 7, verse 12. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can see the written version of this commentary, as well as hundreds more commentaries and podcasts at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. You can also find other articles and links to books written by the author at that website. Once again, it's www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.